Welcome. Let's start this press briefing of the UN Information Service here in Geneva. We have a long list of speakers and invitees today, so I'll start immediately with our colleagues of OHCHR. Ravina, who's on the podium with me, brought Li Fung, who is the head of the UN Human Rights Office in Sudan. I would like to welcome her. I hope she's online. Let me see. She is. Okay. Li Fung, here. Welcome. You want to start? Okay. Go ahead, Ravina.
Thanks. Good morning, everyone. You will have received a report that we've just issued on Sudan, which makes, unfortunately, for very grim reading. This is a report that the High Commissioner will present to the Human Rights Council in its upcoming session. Entrenched impunity is fueling gross human rights violations and abuses in Sudan as fighting spreads to more parts of the country and involves additional armed actors. Broader international effort is needed towards accountability and to stem the flow of arms. The report details attacks on densely populated areas, as well as IDP camps, markets, and schools, as well as a sustained pattern of attacks on medical facilities. It also documents ethnically motivated summary executions. The continued and deliberate attacks on civilians and civilian objects, as well as summary executions, sexual violence, and other violations and abuses, underscore the utter failure by both parties to respect the rules and principles of international humanitarian and human rights law. Some of these acts may amount to war crimes. They must be investigated promptly and independently, with a view to bringing those responsible to justice. The international community should, among other measures, expand the arms embargo and the jurisdiction of the International Criminal Court to cover the whole of Sudan. They currently only cover the region of Darfur. Conflict-related sexual violence has also been documented, and urgent steps must be taken by the parties to put an end to the persistent use of sexual violence and to hold those responsible to account and to provide redress for survivors. Our report also details widespread disappearances and a generalized crackdown on civic space, including killings of journalists and attacks on human rights defenders. Since April 2023, when the conflict began, it has triggered the world's largest displacement crisis and an unprecedented food security situation, with half the population facing acute food insecurity and famine conditions confirmed in at least 5 locations. The conflict has also undermined the rights to health and education, with 70 to 80% of health facilities rendered non-functional and over 90% of school-age children left with no access to formal education. As fighting intensifies for control of Khartoum and El Fasher, the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Volker Turk, remains very concerned about the protection of civilians, particularly those belonging to groups that have been subjected to persistent discrimination. We stress that accountability, regardless of the rank and affiliation of the perpetrators, is critical to breaking the recurring cycle of violence and impunity in Sudan. I'll pass the floor now to the head of our Sudan office, Ms. Li Fung.
Good morning and greetings from Port Sudan. The report of the High Commissioner on the Situation of Human Rights in Sudan issued today highlights the expansion of the conflict across the country in 2024. It details the devastating impact of hostilities on civilians across Sudan and on fundamental human rights, including to life, liberty, and security, non-discrimination, food, health, and water. Attacks on densely populated areas involving airstrikes, drones, and artillery shelling continue to impact upon civilians and civilian infrastructure, particularly in Khartoum, Darfur, and areas of Kordofan. We documented multiple attacks on civilian objects, including markets, IDP camps, and schools. The report documents deliberate attacks against specifically protected objects, in particular health facilities. For example, the Al Saudi Maternity Hospital in Fasha came under repeated attack in 2024. Thousands of civilian lives have been lost as a result of the hostilities and direct attacks on civilians, including targeted attacks on villages and retaliatory attacks. This includes cases of summary executions that are largely ethnically motivated or based on perceived affiliation to the opposing party to the conflict. As at the end of December 2024, our office had documented 152 incidents of conflict-related sexual violence involving at least 251 victims. Reports of sexual violence appeared to follow a geographic pattern as the fighting spread across the country, illustrating its consistent use as a weapon of war by a growing number of actors. More than half of the reported incidents involved gang rape. Cases of sexual violence remain vastly underreported. In 2024, we documented multiple reports of disappearances and missing persons, including through widespread arbitrary arrests and detention. In this context, civic space came under increasing threat. The report finds that gross violations and abuses of international human rights law, as well as serious violations of international humanitarian law, have been committed by the parties to the conflict, as entrenched impunity was a key driver of the conflict and continues to fuel it. Accountability is critical to prevent further violations and abuses. Since the beginning of 2025, the situation has escalated further, with ongoing battles in multiple hotspots. Regrettably, civilians continue to bear the brunt of the escalating violence. In recent weeks, hostilities have intensified in Khartoum, North Darfur and Kordofan, and more recently in White Nile. We are particularly concerned about recurrent RSF attacks on Zamzam IDP camp in El Fasha and on surrounding villages. We are alarmed about documented summary executions allegedly attributed to SAF-affiliated fighters and militia in Al Jazeera, Khartoum and North Kordofan. Many people were reportedly targeted based on ethnic identity and perceived affiliation with the RSF. Such reports continue to be received in Al Jazeera. We have also received reports of threats against humanitarian volunteers who have stayed behind to help those in need. And there are growing reports of hate speech and incitement to violence, often in the context of targeted attacks against civilians. The increasing ethnic dimensions of the conflict and growing polarization within communities is deeply troubling. Also of concern is an increasing trend of attacks on critical water and power infrastructure. Last week, I visited Kassala in eastern Sudan, where I firsthand the impact of the conflict in areas where there are no active hostilities. Kassala is hosting hundreds of thousands of IDPs who have fled conflict and violence. I had the opportunity to hear from women who have been displaced multiple times. This made clear the major challenges of providing for such large numbers of IDPs and of planning for safe and sustainable returns. I'm here in Port Sudan now, aiming to reinitiate direct dialogue with authorities and institutions to pursue our mandate on the promotion and protection of human rights in Sudan. The situation in Sudan has reached a dangerous tipping point. Now is the time to renew focus on the human rights crisis in Sudan and take all necessary measures to protect civilians and prevent further violations and abuses. It remains urgent to ensure critical humanitarian assistance can reach those in need. Together, we must stand with the people of Sudan.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Lee Fung and Ravina. Just before opening the floor to questions, I'd like to remind you that yesterday our colleagues, both UNHCR and OCHA, launched the 2025 Sudan Humanitarian Needs and Response Plan and the Regional Refugee Response Plans. As you may have heard yesterday from Tom Fletcher, these two appeals, these two plans, request $6 billion to support close to 21 million people in Sudan and up to 5 million others who are primarily refugees in neighboring countries. As Mr. Fletcher said yesterday, it would be a staggering amount to try and raise in normal times, let alone in the midst of a financial crisis that we are experiencing. But there was a first start at the beginning of the last weekend in Addis with $300 million raised. And we really believe that this being a humanitarian crisis is truly unprecedented, as we have also heard from our colleagues. It demands a response unprecedented in scale and intent. And just as a last information for you, also on Sudan, you may have seen that Jean-Pierre Lacroix, our Undersecretary General for Peace Operation, will begin a visit to Sudan, South Sudan, and Abay today until the 24th of February to support, to strengthen the cooperation coordination supporting peacekeeping efforts in the region. So I'll open the floor to questions on Sudan now. Nina, so I'll introduce you for Lee. Nina Larson, AFP.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my question. I wanted to ask if you have more details on the ethnically motivated summary executions, if you have can provide numbers and the increase you may have seen there, and also in terms of rape being used as a weapon of war, is that also, are you also seeing ethnically motivated instances of that? Thank you.
Ravina Fung, okay. Can you, would you like to take this one, Li Feng? Thanks.
Yes. In terms of the summary executions, the recent summary executions, these have been outlined in recent press releases in the course of January. What we have been able to do, we do not have comprehensive figures. It has been very difficult to reach these comprehensive figures because of cuts in telecommunications, in the security challenges, also because of fear of reprisals. But what we have documented in Al Jazeera State and in Khartoum, as well as in North Kordofan, are that these attacks are retaliatory against civilians based on their perceived affiliation with the RSF, and that they're oftenly ethnically directed, based on their identity from Darfurian or Kordofan Aryans, tribes from Western Sudan. What we are also continuing to do is we are continuing to receive reports from Al Jazeera, which we are trying to follow up. In terms of rape and the ethnically motivated rape, indeed, as outlined in the report of the High Commissioner, in West Darfur, we had documented multiple cases of rape that were ethnically motivated against the Masalit community from late 2023 and early 2024.
Other questions in the room? Beyza is our correspondent of the Turkish News Agency.
Morning, Alessandra. Thank you for taking my question. I don't know if Ravina would like to answer or Ms. Lee, but first I would like to ask about, there are concerning reports about progress of the Sudanese army in many fronts against rapid forces. Do you think this could have any ease on the facilitating of humanitarian aid or any good or bad impact in general? Also, the second question, the report recommends expanding the arms embargo beyond Darfur. What specific measures needed as many weapons entering Sudan reportedly coming from the regional actors? And how is the UN engaging with neighboring countries to curb arms smuggling and prevent external actors from fueling the conflict? Thank you.
Thanks, Beyza. I'll take the question on the arms embargo and the flow of arms, and I'll ask my colleague Lee to take the question on humanitarian access. On the flow of arms, it's no secret, it's very clear that arms continue to flow into Sudan. We are seeing the use of very heavy weaponry in populated civilian areas. What is currently in place is an arms embargo put forth by the Security Council on Darfur in particular. And what we are calling for is for the arms embargo to be extended throughout Sudan. The High Commissioner has repeatedly called on all states who have any involvement or any leverage over parties to the conflict to use that leverage to bring this conflict to an end and to bring peace to the people of Sudan, and we would reiterate that call. International humanitarian law also requires that states respect and ensure respect for IHL, for international humanitarian law, and this encompasses the prohibition on arms transfers where there's a real risk that such arms would be used in the commission of violations against international humanitarian law.
Li Feng?
Yes, and in relation to the increasing hostilities and battles of control, in various areas, particularly in Khartoum. Indeed, as I mentioned, this very fluid and dynamic security situation is a challenge to human rights, to protection, and indeed to the broader engagement of the UN in providing humanitarian assistance. It is, for us, we will not speak to the issues of the humanitarian access. I think that, as was mentioned, this is part of the humanitarian response plan that was launched yesterday. But indeed, the very volatile situation poses greater risks, poses greater security challenges, and thus is a complicating factor. Thank you.
Thank you very much. You have a follow-up?
Quick follow-up for Ravina. Are you concerned about, as you say, there is already a selective arms embargo only affecting Darfur. Are you worried about the expanding of the embargo would not have the biggest impact as you were expecting, as they already have a stockpiles of weapons? Thank you.
The arms embargo on Darfur is also clearly not being respected. And again, this is why we are renewing our call to everyone who has any involvement. Now, this is states that may be providing weapons. It's also states that may have involvement through the supply chain as well in the provision of weapons towards this conflict, to both parties to the conflict. They need to be reminded of their obligations, not only do the parties to the conflict need to ensure that civilians are not harmed in the use of these weapons, but those who are providing arms, who are carrying out arms transfers, also need to be reminded that they have an obligation to ensure that such arms are not used in violation of international humanitarian law. And as you can see from this report, we have documented many violations that could amount to war crimes.
Thank you very much. I saw Taha Hassan, APTN.
Thank you. The situation in Sudan requires immediate action. Unfortunately, any action hasn't been taken. If there is any action be taken by United Nations or human rights, and could you also identify who has committed these violations in Sudan? Which part?
Taha, thank you for your question. I'll start with a response, and perhaps my colleague Lee might want to supplement just on the work that we are trying to do as the UN Human Rights Office on Sudan. Who is committing the violations? Unfortunately, we have documented the perpetration of gross human rights violations by both the Sudanese armed forces as well as the rapid support forces. You may recall that the High Commissioner spoke to both generals last year as well, and again, he reminded them of their obligations under international human rights law and humanitarian law to ensure that the principles of distinction, proportionality are respected. Unfortunately, since then, we have only seen a worsening of the situation. The parties to the conflict seem to be more motivated by power interests than for the for peace for the people of Sudan.
Lee, go ahead.
In terms of what we are doing as the UN Human Rights Office in Sudan, we have been working since 2019 pursuant to an agreement with the government of Sudan on the promotion and protection of human rights. This involves our monitoring and documentation mandate. It also involves engagement with institutions, with a broad range of interlocutors, including civil society, to be able to strengthen the promotion and protection of human rights in Sudan. Very specifically in this conflict context, we are working very closely with our UN with our UN partners and also with humanitarian partners to be able to support the response to this crisis. I wanted to reiterate again that this is a humanitarian and protection crisis that has driven the very, very enormous humanitarian crisis that has already been spoken to. Thank you.
Sorry. I would also like to remind you that the Secretary General was at the African Union meeting just now, and we have sent you extensive transcripts and readouts of his meetings. He really focused on the situation in DRC and Sudan, so I would like to send you back to what he said on that occasion. And in particular, when he was asked by one of your colleagues about the work that the UN were doing with the two parties, parties in Sudan, he answered that his special envoy, Lamamra, has been in contact with the two sides. The SG himself had some contacts, and we believe that it's absolutely essential that in the holy month of Ramadan, Sudan uses this occasion to stop the fighting and create the conditions for diplomacy finally to be possible. And he wrote, he spoke about Sudan much more, so I'll refer you to his interventions. Next question, let me see, I don't see in the room or on the platform. So I'd like to thank you very much. We have changed a little bit the agenda of the briefing. So Ravina's not going away. And we also have Tamim from OHCHR, because I know that some of you had questions for them. But I'd like now to thank Ravina. If you can stay on the podium, you can stay, but we will go now to Ukraine. And thank you very much, Lifang, for being with us from Port Sudan. Good luck with your important work. And I'd like now to call on our colleagues of UNHCR and IFRC to come to the podium to talk about the situation. Thank you, Ravina. I'll see you in a moment on DRC. And I'd like to invite them to come to the podium because we will have a briefing on the situation in Ukraine. So I'd like to welcome, thank you for, oh, sorry, my coat is there. Sorry, maybe you can give it to me, thank you. Okay, so let me introduce you. Of course, we have Matt for UNHCR. I don't need to introduce you to him, but we also have the pleasure to welcome Philippe Leclerc, who is the UNHCR Director of the Regional Bureau for Europe of UNHCR. And on my right, Tommaso Della Lunga, again, not need to introduce him, but he brought us Birgit Bischoff-Ebbesen, who is the IFRC Regional Director for Europe. And both colleagues will tell us about the situation in Ukraine. So I'd like to start with you, Philippe, to hear about the situation in Ukraine after 3 years of war, and then we'll go to Birgit. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Indeed, I visited and accompanied the High Commissioner in January to his sixth visit to Ukraine since the full-scale invasion, and almost at 3 years of anniversary of the invasion, the full-scale invasion, the resilience of the people is obviously remarkable, but 3 years of war have had so devastating consequences on so many people. Thousands of people have died. 10.6 million Ukrainians are displaced, 3.7 million of them within Ukraine, and around almost 7 million refugees throughout the world, mostly in Europe, continue to receive protection abroad. So each time we visit Ukraine, in particular the oblasts which are under intense military attack, in particular since the beginning of the winter on the energy infrastructure, we see the further consequences of the trauma among children, among elderly, among people with disabilities, all these people who in Donetsk, in Dnipro, in Sumy, in Kherson, in so many of these oblasts which are under continuous attack, remain in the vicinity and receive key humanitarian support in terms of collective centers when they have no home, shelter support, psychological support, legal assistance support, so that as quickly as possible they can benefit from the support of strained Ukrainian national services. At this time, in the heart of the winter, at the time when every day on these oblasts we continue to see the consequences of the missile attacks, humanitarian assistance is key in enabling these populations to continue to remain if they wish to do so. And many, again, elderly people with disabilities are staying in these frontline areas. It is key that the humanitarian support continues. A lot is debated about future peace, and we welcome all actions which go towards peace. The Ukrainian people need peace, but we know that it will take time. Right now, what I need to convey to you, convey to donors, is the support that continues to be required so that this country, which is affected by mines, ordnance, perhaps 1/3 of the country has been affected by mine. It will take time, even if peace comes, to support the people who will need to come back, the people who are remaining in those areas, and the humanitarian assistance needs to be supported. You know that funding has always been difficult. It is, as we speak, even more difficult, not only with the many conflicts all over the world which require a response, but after 3 years, it is important, of 3 years of full-scale, consequences of full-scale invasion, it is absolutely important that the state donors, as well as private donors, continue to fund the humanitarian actors. And I'm glad to be today with Birgitte, as the Red Cross movement is so important in responding to the needs. We are not alone as UNHCR. We work with the rest of the UN family, and even more importantly, with the local actors. Most of the actions that we are able to implement to support these victims of the population are national actors. Right to Protection, 10th of April, NICA, 13 out of the 14 partners we have in Ukraine are local actors. 90% of the procurement we make is done in Ukraine. All this is part of the UN and UNHCR effort to support the government of Ukraine, the civil society, the NGOs, to respond to the needs of the Ukrainian people. I'll stop here and be ready to take your questions.
Thank you very much. And just before I give the floor to Birgit, just on what Philippe just said, let me remind you that in 2025, the UN and partners are appealing for $3.32 billion to support 8.2 million people affected by the crisis in Ukraine and across the borders. And out of this appeal, the humanitarian needs and response plan is only funded 12.7% as of today. Birgit. You also have your first-hand experience to tell us about.
Thank you very much. And yes, indeed, the situation in Ukraine, I can only echo what Philippe is saying. We are only 1 week away from the three-year mark, and at the same time, it has been such a long time and a very short time. I have indeed literally just returned from Ukraine, where I've had the opportunity to visit Sumy, which is the area that is sharing a very extensive borderline with Russia. And there, what you see is that people live under a constant shadow of the conflict. You see homes, schools, health, and energy infrastructure that has been destroyed. And air raids are part of the day. It's relentless, it's day, it's night, and taking a really huge toll on people's mental health, but also on their general well-being. Maybe some of you would recall that last week we presented at this same press briefing the challenges that we see for people both inside Ukraine, but also the people that are living outside of Ukraine. They are reaching a tipping point where staying abroad is no longer sustainable, but returning home means returning into some kind of uncertainty. And what we're seeing is that more than one in four of the returnees settle very close to the front lines, and that the daily realities are tough for them. Nearly 80% of the returnees in frontline areas report that they see urgent, unmet humanitarian needs. What they need is food, what Philippe also mentioned, shelter, medical care, and jobs. It's not really what they find there. And also, across the board, since October, prices in Ukraine have been increasing around 50% is that number. So things are getting more expensive and humanitarian conditions difficult. At the same time, I want to share with you that the resilience of the people that I met in the border area, I met in Sumy, is that they are extremely determined and they really want to stay despite the risks. And many people that we met have been evacuated away from the exact borderline, but are living in an area of like 10, 20, 30 kilometers away from that, and they want to stay there. What we also see is that what the branch in Sumy was sharing, that the older people in Sumy, they are of particular need. It's difficult for them to sustain themselves. They need home care support, which is difficult to maintain, medical services and basic social protection. And they are often the ones that are just staying. We also had the opportunity to meet children. And I met children that have been online schooling for 3 years. They were in a facility where we did some psychosocial services with them, or the Red Cross of Ukraine did. And it was amazing to see how they were finally together with someone again, together with their mates. And they are trying now to find ways of having schooling, but properly within shelters, to find enough space so they can resume schooling that is not online. If I go to talking about what the Ukraine Red Cross volunteers are doing, I mean, I met some incredible young men and women, the first responders, and they are the ones who are going into the affected areas when everybody else is trying to go the other way. And they are on call still. We are 3 years in, and they are on call day and night. They're evacuating single persons, families. They are delivering first aid and helping people to reach safety. So it's really impressive also to see how communities in Ukraine are finding ways to rebuild and help themselves to recover. And we were told that the farmers in Sumy, they are trying to find ways to keep up the farming production levels with efficiency gains, because they cannot cultivate all the land that they could before. So they really, it was amazing to see how many solutions that were also found despite the difficult environment. So in light of also the ongoing discussions about a possible peace deal that Philippe was also highlighting, one thing is certain, that whether there is an agreement today or not, the humanitarian needs in Ukraine will remain immense. Millions of people are still affected by the conflict and they need humanitarian aid today, and they will need support long after the fighting is ending. The IFRC and our network of 60 Red Cross and Red Crescent societies are committed to continue supporting people affected by the conflict. They are from the communities they serve, and they are really well placed to respond. And Ukraine Red Cross has been at the heart of the humanitarian response since day one, and we have been helping them in that endeavor. They are adapting to the strange realities of responding to immense emergency needs, while also helping the communities rebuild and recover long term. But even with all these efforts, the future is uncertain, the needs are growing, and the funding is shrinking. At the same time, policies in host countries are changing and leaving the Ukrainians struggling to make impossible choices. So yeah, it's time for the governments, the donors, and the international community to reaffirm their commitment. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Birgit. And I'd like now to open the floor to questions. Isabel Sacco is our correspondent of the Spanish news agency, EFE.
Good morning. I would like to ask, what is your position on a reflection that many European countries are having nowadays? Because in March, I think the European Union and also Switzerland will have to review the special refugee status for Ukrainian people. And for example, in Switzerland, they have in first step decided, it's not completely decided by the executive, but decided to restrain this special status to people that are from occupied territories in Ukraine or people that are in territories attacked by Russia. So what, and this is something that other countries are, I mean, political sectors in other countries are asking also to review because of the funding, the amid the budgetary restrictions and all this. So what is your position on how much longer the countries should continue to protect Ukrainian people? Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. Indeed, well, first I want to thank all the European countries who continue to provide temporary protection, as it's referred to. This is the instrument that the EU member states and Switzerland, Norway, Moldova have provided and continue to provide to around 6 million refugees. This is an important effort. It needs to continue. What the European Commission and Member States have agreed to is that the Temporary Protection Directive will continue to apply until March 26. Hopefully during that time, more efforts can be led and done to achieve ceasefire or peace, lasting peace, that would enable the temporary protection and the international protection regime to cease. But we are not there, and what we are asking states to do is to continue to host the refugees they host from Ukraine, while some states, as you have said, Norway and Switzerland, have made some conditions on the support they will provide in the future to those who would originate from Oblast, which are, according to them, safer than others. I would like to remind UNHCR's position, and as I have witnessed in my recent stay in Ukraine, that all parts of Ukraine continue to be hit. On a daily basis, Kyiv is hit. Lviv was hit recently, as well as other so-called safer oblasts. And on a daily basis, Kherson, Dnipro, Odessa, and so many others continue to be hit on a daily basis. So my response is very clear. We need the temporary protection to continue as long as war has not stopped in Ukraine.
Thank you very much. Have a follow-up, Isabel?
Yeah, go ahead. Thank you. If we have in the short term a peace agreement, how? Because you said the time for Ukrainians to go back, I mean, this process will take time. So how long do you think we will need for the Ukrainians to go back to its country where they will find the conditions to live?
I would like to be able to respond precisely to your question. The experience we have had as UNHCR for more than 75 years in terms of return of refugees is that all depends on the sustainable peace. A ceasefire is sometimes something that only lasts for days, which can be broken. So we need a sustainable peace for refugees to be willingly going back to their country. Actually, since the beginning of the war, 1.3 million people had returned at one stage, particularly in the beginning of the war, to Ukraine. We see back and forth movements. It's very important that the Ukrainian people keep their relationship with the Ukrainian culture, with the Ukrainian education. And many efforts are made, including by the government of Ukraine, by instituting a new Ministry of National Unity, which is supposed to have some unit hubs in the countries hosting large refugee populations, like in Germany, in Poland, and in the Czech Republic before others. So this link between the Ukraine and Ukrainians has to be kept, entertained, but as long as peace has not been reached, this precious international protection, temporary protection that they're having in neighboring countries and beyond is important to continue. So I cannot give you a date.
Thank you very much. Other questions in the room or online? Got about 50 people online, but I am not seeing any hand up, so I guess there are none. So thank you very much. I think we will continue speaking about Ukraine also at the next briefing. But thanks to our colleagues for being here. Philippe, Birgitte just come out of the plane to come and brief you. So thank you very much. And yes, we will continue talking about that. Matt, can you stay on the podium? And I'll ask Ravina to come back. Let's go to the third topic of our briefing today, which is the situation in Eastern DRC. I don't know who wants to speak first.
Mark can start.
Let's start with Matt. Matt, go ahead. Thank you.
Good morning, everyone. I can give you a brief update on the situation of arrivals in Burundi from the Democratic Republic of the Congo. UNHCR can confirm that between 10,000 and 15,000 people have crossed into Burundi over the last few days, fleeing escalating tensions and violence in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. The majority of those arriving are Congolese, mainly from the Bukavu area in South Kivu, where the situation is deteriorating. A smaller number of Burundian nationals have also returned to their country, fleeing the clashes. People are mainly arriving at the Gatumba border post, close to the capital, Bujumbura. They're exhausted and traumatized. Many of them have been separated from their families with little information on their whereabouts. UNHCR's teams on the ground are there to ensure people arriving in search of safety receive the support that they so badly need as they await registration and further reception procedures. There are also reports of thousands arriving through unofficial border points, including on the Rusizi River near Rugombo, with reports of several individuals drowning, tragically. Conditions in the communities near the border are dire, with a serious lack of shelter, water, and sanitation facilities. In one location, over 10,400 people are currently sheltering in schools and a local stadium as they wait to be relocated to safer settlements inland. National authorities, with UNHCR supporting them, are verifying and screening new arrivals to identify those in need of international protection and informing new arrivals on the available services which are there for them. Once registered, refugees are relocated to transit centers where UNHCR and our partners are providing life-saving supplies, including food, clean drinking water, and essential health services. However, overcrowding in transit centers, with some currently hosting up to four times their initial capacity, is becoming a major concern, and resources are stretched. And that's heightening tensions among the arrivals. With the government of Burundi, UNHCR and partners are working to ensure that refugees can access the assistance and protection that they need. While we're making every effort to respond to this emergency, there is an urgent need for additional resources. The situation in the eastern DRC remains extremely challenging and fluid, with recent clashes in South Kivu forcing more than 150,000 people to flee. At least 85,000 of these individuals are living in newly created spontaneous sites for internally displaced people, where basic services such as water, shelter, and access to health are in extremely short supply. At the same time, rapid support to provide basic services in the zones of return in North Kivu is urgently needed as an increasing number of households, about 80 a day from South Kivu, make the journey back to their original villages. Aside from Burundi, the number of people fleeing the DRC across borders since the start of the recent escalation of the conflict has remained relatively low. However, UNHCR teams are on the ground in the neighboring countries and prepared to assist if needed. And here, of course, we're talking about Rwanda, Uganda, Tanzania, and Zambia. The new influx joins the 91,000 refugees and asylum seekers already in Burundi, and most of those are from the DRC, and many of them have been in the country for decades.
Thank you, Matt. Ravina.
Thank you, Matt. Thanks, Alessandra. The situation in Eastern Democratic Republic of the Congo is deteriorating sharply, resulting in serious human rights violations and abuses, such as summary executions, including of children, and conflict-related sexual and gender-based violence. There have also been attacks on hospitals and humanitarian warehouses, as well as threats against the judiciary. The Rwanda-backed M23 advance to South Kivu has plunged the region into a complex security and humanitarian crisis, provoking population displacement. Our office has confirmed cases of summary execution of children by M23 after they entered the city of Bukavu last week. We're also aware that children were in possession of weapons. We call on Rwanda and M23 to ensure that human rights and international humanitarian law are respected. We're also documenting cases of ill treatment, conflict-related sexual and gender-based violence, child and forced recruitment, intimidation, and death threats. Additionally, we have received information about arbitrary arrests and detentions, degrading treatment, and alleged forced returns of Congolese young men fleeing violence in neighboring countries. Following the prison break from Kabare and Bukavu central prisons on the 14th of February, we've received protection requests from victims and witnesses. They fear retaliation from escapees given their active participation in the trials against some of these prisoners who were convicted of grave human rights violations and abuses, some of which amount to international crimes. We also have concerns for the safety of lawyers and other judicial staff. We've received reports that journalists, human rights defenders, and members of civil society organizations have been threatened and forced to leave the area. Others are still stuck in Bukavu and in Goma and have expressed fears for their safety due to their active engagement for human rights and their denunciation of violations and abuses committed by Rwanda and the M23 in various territories of the Eastern DRC. The UN Human Rights Chief Volker Turk calls on Rwanda and the M23 to protect all individuals in territories under their control. He expresses his horror at the events unfolding in South and North Kivu and the impact that this is having on civilians. The violence must stop immediately. All parties must respect international humanitarian law, in particular regarding the protection of civilians and human rights law. They must resume dialogue within the framework of the Luanda and Nairobi processes. The risks of this spilling over into an even deeper and wider conflict are frighteningly real and will have even more devastating consequences on civilians.
Thank you very much. And before opening the floor to question, let me remind you that in the framework of the African Union Summit, the Secretary General spoke at length about the situation in DRC. He also met with the Prime Minister of DRC, and we've sent out the readout of that meeting. Okay, I'll start with Jeremy.
Thank you. Ravina, it's not that often that your office is able to say that a specific group is responsible of arbitrary executions. You're saying that the M23 is responsible for summary execution of children. I'd like to have a bit more details on that. Are you able to say how many children were being executed? And you're saying in your statement that you're aware that children were in possession of weapons. What do you mean? Do you mean that the M23 executed children, child soldiers, or you know what I mean? Are we talking about child soldiers being executed, regular children being executed? Can you have specific details on that thing?
No, thanks for that. It is a very chaotic situation. We are receiving a lot of information, a lot of which we are not able to confirm or verify. In this case, what we have managed to confirm is that, so first of all, there are videos circulating on social networks that show children who are between the ages of 11 and 15, who appear to be between the ages of 11 and 15, allegedly using abandoned uniforms. These are uniforms that were abandoned by the FARDC, and weapons, who are firing shots and looting stores. We also have a report that on the 16th of February, in a neighborhood called the Latin Quarter in Bukavu, three boys were killed during an altercation with members of M23. According to information collected through reliable sources, the three boys who are yet to be identified were carrying weapons collected in an abandoned FARDC camp and were intercepted by the M23. They refused to disarm, and during an exchange of fire that subsequently erupted, the three children were killed. Family members have not yet claimed the bodies. We can't confirm their exact ages at this moment as well. But what we are trying to do is to confirm some of the reports that we're receiving. These are alarming enough that we felt we had to make them public.
Sorry, Agnes, I had seen another hand before. Okay, no hand, so just go ahead.
Yes, thank you for taking my question. In fact, it was almost all the questions were asked, but if I could do a follow-up, beyond those three cases that you, three children that you mentioned now, what is the global figure of cases that you have been able to confirm? And the statement is talking about Bukavu, but I was wondering if this is something that you have also seen in Goma or in other places in East DRC. Thank you.
Thanks, Agnes. We don't have a global figure. We have a lot of reports that, again, we're trying to sift through because we need to verify them. There's a lot of videos on social media and other reports that we're receiving from actors on the ground. UNICEF had also issued a very strong press release the other day on violence against children generally in the context of this conflict, including sexual violence. And unfortunately, there's a history of this. We have received reports in the past as well of horrific violations, summary executions, and killings of children by the M23, as well as horrific sexual violence against women and girls.
Yes, sorry, and specifically on Goma, since the fact that they have taken Goma, or it wasn't clear to me if the cases you refer were before in the past,
before,
a long time ago, or since they have taken Goma.
Both. So we have received reports in the past as well. But since Goma has been taken, we have received a lot of cases of sexual violence. Again, sexual violence is notoriously difficult to document and to get an accurate figure on. But we have received a lot of cases of sexual violence since Goma was taken.
Nina?
Thanks, Ravina. I was just wondering about the three cases that you mentioned in response to Jeremy's question. It sounds like they were killed more in a firefight. I'm just wondering, can you define what you mean by summary execution? Thank you.
What appears to have happened is that they were asked to surrender their weapons, and they refused to do so, and they were killed.
Okay, Isabel.
Now, you mentioned that you were asked to provide a protection to a group of people, I suppose activists. Or what kind of protection are you able to give to people that approach you? And what is your presence in Bukavu, sorry. What is your presence there? And when also on your warn about the escalation and the ramification of this conflict to other places, could you have some information that allow you to tell that this is an imminent risk? No? Thank you.
On the kind of protection that we're able to provide, I can't really get into details on that, but the High Commissioner spoke about this also when he spoke to the Human Rights Council on the 7th of February at the special session. We do receive a lot of requests for protection from journalists, from human rights defenders, from judicial authorities as well, who are being threatened or pursued by the M23 and Rwanda forces. We have facilitated this protection. I don't think I can get into details on that, however. I'm so sorry, I've forgotten your second question. Our presence, yes, we do have a presence in the East. Again, I can't get into details, but several of our staff were considered to be essential staff, so they have stayed in the East. But we have presences across the DRC as well.
Sorry,
I'm just being told we have no one for the time being in Bukavu specifically, though.
And on your question about the regional ramifications, I think the Secretary General was very voiceful when he said that the situation in DRC threatens to push the entire region over the precipice. I think he said this at the African Union summit, and he reminded that there is no military solution to the country's conflict. It can only be solved by dialogue. Other hands up before I go to the platform? No, so Catherine Fianco.
Yes, good morning, Alessandra. Good morning to all of you. Thank you for the briefing. Matt, could you please?
Wait a second. Okay, now it's better.
Okay. So good morning to all, and thank you for the briefing. Matt, could you please send your notes? I'll go back first to Ravina. Ravina, please, regarding two things. Are there child soldiers? Do you have any evidence? Because if I understood well what you told my colleagues, what happened with the children that have been killed is more kind of children that found weapons and played with it or didn't want to leave them. But it's not clear if these children were kind of child soldiers working for a group or kids that found uniforms and weapons. My second question is regarding what you said, violence against children and women, very well known in eastern part of DR Congo. You just mentioned that it was done, if I'm not mistaken, please correct me, by M23 forces. So could you be precise about that? And regarding the protection of journalists and human rights defenders from M23, is it only in the region of Bukavu and Goma? Or is it also globally in the country? Because I know that many journalists have been threatened and some had to leave the country in order not to be killed. And questions for Matt, could you please tell us the presence of UNHCR in Burundi? How many transit centers you have there? You said that they're overcrowded, so could you tell us, be more precise about that, overcrowded, how many people are there, and also resources, how much money are you looking for? Thank you so much to both of you.
Thanks, Catherine. The cases that I mentioned, these were, we understand, children who picked up uniforms, discarded uniforms and discarded weapons, who were killed. However, there are reports of the forced recruitment and conscription of children, for sure. And unfortunately, this has also been seen quite frequently, unfortunately, in the context of the conflict in the eastern DRC. On sexual violence, again, unfortunately, we have documented reports over the years of various parties using sexual violence as a weapon of war. And as I said, it's very difficult for us to document cases of sexual violence, again, because of the stigma associated with it, because of the lack of also medical facilities where women would be able to access immediate medical care. On the protection, we have, I'm just looking at the information that I have, we have received requests for protection from 52 human rights defenders and civil society actors under threat in South Kivu over just the last 5 days. And we've recorded allegations of 2 killed in Kalehe. Since the deterioration, we have seen many others who are also threatened to be killed either by the M23 or by unidentified armed elements that are assimilated into the M23. A lot of journalists have left. Some have stayed, however, in South and North Kivu. I don't have information on the rest of the country. I think that was all your questions for me.
And I can add a few details for you, Catherine, on the situation in Burundi. We've noticed arrivals in several communes within Cibitoke province, as well as the Gutumba border post in Bujumbura rural province. And of course, these have been driven by the instability in eastern DRC. There are, within Buganda commune, there are three unofficial crossing points. And on one day, for example, on February the 15th, there were around 650 arrivals reported there. There's also a transit center in Kisimea, which has seen significant arrivals, as well as Gihanga, which is in Bujumbura rural province. I mentioned 10 to 15,000 as the total number who have arrived since the escalation in the fighting and the crisis in the DRC. I don't have exact numbers for our staff who are on the ground in Burundi, but I can try to get that to you later on. And in terms of our funding situation for the DRC, we have an appeal for $226 million, which is currently, sadly, only around 10% funded. And for Burundi, the Burundi situation, for last year, we were 40% funded, and that was an appeal of less than $100 million. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Maybe just to call your attention on what Ravina mentioned before, which is the press release that was issued by UNICEF on the 17th of February, where they were putting the accent on the issue of the schools. There were more, since the beginning of the year, more than 2,500 schools and learning spaces which have been closed in North and South Kivu. And of course, that is a terrible situation for 795,000 children deprived of education, which of course is a factor that normally would play a crucial role in maintaining stability and providing a safe space for children, saving them from potential recruitment by armed groups. And this element, of course, is now missing and not protecting the children from recruitment as child soldiers. Next question goes to Emma.
Good morning, Matt. I was hoping you could elaborate a little bit more on your statement. There were two aspects I'm interested in. One, could you say a bit more about the scale? You said 10 to 15,000 crossing into Burundi through formal, that you've actually formally registered, but how many do you think have crossed in total, including via the informal crossings? And you alluded to tensions in Burundi. Could you elaborate on what you were referring to and what your concerns are for possible flare-ups with local communities? Thanks very much.
Thanks, Emma. I don't have any additional estimates above and beyond what we have given for Burundi. It is quite possible that the numbers are slightly higher, given the fact that people haven't been solely crossing through mandated border points. In terms of the situation over the border in Burundi at the transit centres, I think the tensions are mainly around the scarcity of resources, the need to move people away from the border areas, trying to find shelter and accommodation for them, and trying to get humanitarian aid into those areas quickly. And I did mention some other countries, and of course, while the numbers are significantly lower there, we are, of course, ready to support and react if we're needed in those countries as well with our staff on the ground there.
Thank you very much, Matt. Thanks, everyone, for your questions. I don't see any more. So I'd like to ask maybe Ravina to stay on the podium and ask Tamin to come for briefing you on the situation of human rights in Tunisia. Thanks, Matt.
Welcome.
Thank you.
While Tamim is preparing his briefing, I just would like to remind you that tomorrow, the president of the Human Rights Council, Jörg Lauber, will hold a press conference for you here in this room at 10 a.m. Of course, the president will brief you on the upcoming 58th session of the Human Rights Council that will begin on Monday. We'll hear more about it also on Friday from Pascal. Tamim.
Thank you, Alessandra. Good morning, everyone. The Tunisian authorities must bring an end to the pattern of arrests, arbitrary detentions, and imprisonment of dozens of human rights defenders, lawyers, journalists, activists, and politicians. Many of them are being held in pretrial detention, facing broad and vague accusations, apparently following the exercise of their rights and freedoms. This raises concerns with respect to violations of the right to freedom of expression, as well as fair trial and due process. Over 40 individuals, including opponents from various political affiliations, are scheduled to stand trial at the beginning of March before the Court of First Instance in Tunis. They are part of a group accused of conspiracy against the state, as well as terrorism-related charges. At least seven of them have been in pretrial detention since February 2023. A number who are out of the country will be tried in absentia. And as we speak, Abdelrazak Krimi, project director of the Tunisian Refugee Council, enters his third week on hunger strike in detention. He was arrested in May last year, along with the NGO's head, Mustafa Jmali. Both are accused of illegally sheltering sub-Saharan migrants. Abir Moussi, lawyer and president of the Free Dastourian Party, who has been detained since October 2023, has been on hunger strike for a week. She is facing charges in five cases, including two related to freedom of expression. Lawyer Sonia Dahmani was arrested for statements she made on a national radio about racism and the situation of sub-Saharan migrants in Tunisia. After she was initially sentenced to 1 year in prison, the Court of Appeal in January reduced her sentence to 6 months. Earlier this month, the Court of First Instance handed down prison sentences ranging from 5 to 54 years to 41 individuals in what is known as the Instalingo case. The charges included plotting conspiracy against the state security and committing offenses against the country's president in a trial marred by alleged violations of fair trial and due process. Among those convicted are politicians, journalists, and bloggers. Meanwhile, former Truth and Dignity Commission President Siham Bin Sidreen, who is 75 years old, remains in prison awaiting trial. Last month, the authorities extended her detention for 4 more months. She was taken to hospital recently after being on hunger strike for 2 weeks. UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Volker Türk, calls on the Tunisian authorities to cease all forms of persecution of political opponents and to respect the rights to freedom of opinion and expression. He also appeals for the immediate release on compassionate grounds of those who are of an advanced age and those who suffer from health problems. We also urge Tunisia to review its criminal legislation and ensure it is in line with international human rights law, norms, and standards. All those arbitrarily detained must be immediately and unconditionally released. Those charged with offenses must be guaranteed fair trial and due process. Thank you.
Thank you, Tamim. Questions on Tunisia, please, Isabel?
Do you know how many of the 40 that will be judged in March are in Tunisia, how many of them are out of the country?
We know that a number of them will be tried in absentia. I don't have the exact number, but I can get back to you after verifying with my colleagues. Thank you.
Other questions in the room? can go to the platform. Yes, go ahead.
Yes, and this person, these people that are in a hunger strike, are able to receive visits from any human rights organization to see what are their situation? What is their situation?
Yes, our office in Tunis is actually in touch with the families of these people. We know, for example, that when Siham bin Sidreen was on hunger strike, she was hospitalized, and at first the access was blocked and she could not receive visits. But at some point, her family could visit her, and she agreed to suspend her hunger strike when she saw the amount of support she received. Thank you.
Indeed. Any other question? No, I don't see any. So thank you very much to our HR colleagues. And I'll ask Giovanna to come to the podium. Thank you.
Thank you, Ravina.
Thank you, Rami. So, Giovanna, you have a topic on road safety. Yeah. Ah, that's why you have this here. Okay. Yes. Wow. Yeah, that's interesting.
Well, good morning, colleagues. Thank you very much. As you can see, we'll be speaking about road safety and helmet safety today. Wearing quality helmets reduces the risk of death for drivers and passengers of powered 2- and 3-wheelers by over 6 times and reduces the risk of brain injury by up to 74%. The UN Regulation Number 22 has provided countries with the blueprint to legislate the use of tested and certified helmets for over 50 years. It's already applied in 43 countries, and millions of lives could be saved throughout the worldwide application of this standard. As governments and stakeholders come together for the 4th Ministerial Conference on Road Safety in Marrakesh, taking place these days, actually from 18th to 20th of February, UNECE and the UN Secretary General's Special Envoy for Road Safety, Jean Todt, are launching a call for widespread enforcement of this UN regulation. Over the past 20 and 30 years, the use of 3- and 2-wheelers has grown rapidly as many countries, notably low and middle-income countries, have motorized. Motorcycles comprise nearly 70% of the national vehicle fleet in countries like India, Indonesia, the Philippines, and China. However, the lack of widespread systematic approach to ensuring safety has led to a huge increase in deaths and injuries on the road. According to the latest WHO Global Road Safety Report, motorcyclists and other powered 2- and 3-wheeler riders represent 30% of the 1.19 million global road traffic deaths every year. This marks a 25% increase in the number of victims since 2013. Head injuries are being the main cause of death in most motorcycle crashes, and non-use of helmets among motorcyclists across some 40 countries was reported at 20% for drivers and 30% for passengers. So since the entry into force of the UN Regulation Number 22, 43 countries have applied it. However, with the rapid increase of 2- and 3-wheeler use, application in many more countries around the world could significantly reduce risks on the road. The cost of UN-certified helmets like this one that I showed you can be a barrier to mass use in many countries. And the proliferation of helmets which do not comply with UN Regulation 22 offers a false sense of protection to riders and passengers. And this was recently highlighted in the white paper of the Global Alliance of NGOs for Road Safety. In order to make safe helmets available, to many more road users in developing countries, Special Envoy Jean-Todt launched the Safe and Affordable Helmet Initiative in 2020. This initiative promotes safe helmet use and the development of mass production of UN-certified helmets in developing countries themselves. As a result, producers in India, Indonesia, Spain, and South Korea have already started manufacturing UN-certified helmets for retail at the cost around $20 US. And more than 40,000 helmets financed by partners of this initiative were distributed in some 17 countries across Africa, Latin America, and Southeast Asia. In addition, last year in Rwanda, through a project financed by the UN Road Safety Fund, there was a setting up of a helmet testing facility in December last year. And thanks to this initiative, the national standard and certification scheme with UN Regulation 22 was aligned. The aim is to build the foundations for a vibrant, scalable helmet manufacturing industry to produce a consistent supply of safe and affordable helmets that would be available across Africa. And just to mention that the special envoy for road safety, who is now in Marrakesh at the Global Road Safety Conference, has already distributed 3,000 of these helmets. Yes, so here actually you can see.
They're signed.
Yes, well, it's a printed signature, and you can see here the UN 22, that's the UN regulation approved.
And you want to show it to the camera?
Yes.
That's great.
So there you go.
Incredibly. Oh. Good initiative from UNECE. Thank you very much, Giovanna. Anybody has questions on this thing, which I think is really important and good news for once?
Yes, yes. Good news. Yes.
No questions?
You mentioned that the UN Road Safety Envoy is also promoting this book in Marrakesh as we speak.
Silent Pandemic.
Yes, exactly.
Road.
About the importance of road safety. Financing, proper financing for this issue, and also outline some of the successes and his work so far.
Thank you very much, Giovanna. Any question to UNECE or online? I don't see any. So thank you very much for bringing us this important piece of road safety around the world.
Yes, I think all the details are available to journalists because I also shared in advance our news story about this.
That's great. Thank you very much, Giovanna. Thanks. Let me turn to my right, Francesca Lualdi. Maybe you don't know her yet. I'll introduce her. She's the new Partnership and Communication Officer with UNESCO. She's working at the Liaison Office of UNESCO here in Geneva, and she has an announcement on the International Year of Quantum Science and Technology. Please.
Thank you, Alessandra. The proclamation of 2025 as in the International Year of Quantum Science and Technology calls on the global community to come together to explore the transformative potential of quantum technologies, address upcoming challenges and opportunities, and raise public awareness. As part of this initiative, the UNESCO Liaison Office in Geneva, in collaboration with the Open Quantum Institute, is organizing the inauguration of the International Year of Quantum Science and Technology. The event will take place on February 21st from 9:30 to 12:30 at the Conservatoire de Musique de Genève with the possibility of hybrid participation. This gathering highlights a global commitment to harnessing quantum technologies for sustainable progress with a strong emphasis on equitable access, particularly in education. For more information, please contact gloevents@unesco.org. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Francesca. Questions to UNESCO? I don't see any, so if you can also share the briefing note, that would be perfect. This leaves me only with the announcement about the Committee on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights, just to remind you that they are finishing the review of the report of Rwanda, which started yesterday, finishing it now, this morning, and they still have the Philippines and the Kenya reports to review. And just to inform you that the conference on disarmament has just announced that they will hold a brief plenary meeting of the 2025 session of the conference on Thursday, 20th of February or at 10 a.m. in Tempus. This is all I had for you. If there are no other questions, I think, go ahead, please. Agnès.
Oui, merci Alessandra. Sur le désarmement, par rapport à la semaine prochaine, est-ce qu'il y a déjà des éléments sur la participation du secrétaire général, sur les horaires? Qu'est-ce qu'on peut savoir à ce sujet? Merci.
Par la conférence du désarmement?
Oui.
Non, je n'ai pas de confirmation. On attend, je le dis en français, on attend les informations plus précises sur aussi ce qui va se passer pour la conférence, parce qu'on n'a pas encore reçu confirmation de tous les éléments. Donc je pense qu'on pourra vous le dire très rapidement, mais pour l'instant, je ne peux pas te confirmer quoi que ce soit. Donc, et pour le Conseil des droits de l'homme, bien sûr, demain matin, vous aurez toutes les informations. Mais ça va être une intense semaine, la semaine prochaine. Est-ce qu'il y a d'autres questions? Je n'en vois pas. Donc, merci beaucoup à tout le monde. Thank you very much to everyone. Bon appétit. Thanks for following this long briefing. And I'll see you on Friday. Thanks.